Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Peter, we are following a lot of news today, including what's going on in the United Kingdom, where lawmakers have again rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's plan for a clean Brexit from the European Union. Leaders from other countries in Europe saying today a no-deal Brexit on April the 12th, a crash out, as we've been calling it, is looking far more likely.
Interesting. That's happening today. It's March 29th,
which was the original deadline.
Fascinating story. We'll keep an eye on it. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal reports today that investigators looking into the Boeing 737 MAX jet crash in Ethiopia earlier this month now say it was likely caused by the same thing that doomed the Lion Air flight last year in Indonesia. Joining us now, Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst. Seth, good to have you.
Likewise, Peter. Good to be here.
So it is early, but this preliminary finding does suggest that the automated flight control system is the cause of both crashes, and that's what has been suspected all along.
Peter, almost like putting together a puzzle. You're still missing a few pieces, but you step back and you kind of think you know what you're looking at. In this case, in the days following the Ethiopian Airlines crash, you could kind of see the broad similarities between the two crashes. But as time goes on here, it's taking less imagination to draw the parallels between the two crashes.
On Wednesday, Boeing announced upgrades to the software that controls the anti-stall technology. We talked to you about it when it happened. But we're not hearing a lot about why the sensors themselves are malfunctioning. Is anyone looking into that?
Boeing surely is looking into that. Although I have to tell you, Peter, I haven't seen any evidence yet that the sensors themselves were failing at unusual rates. Mm-hmm. What's unusual here, the anomaly here, is that a bad reading from one sensor could cause catastrophes like this. I mean, Peter, you've probably been on flights where you took a delay because of a bad reading. The pilot says, hey, it's going to take a few minutes, and it might have been the sensor, but we all live to tell about that. So that's what's strange here, is the fact that something like a bad reading could lead to these two disasters.
Seth, as the investigation is ongoing, we got the first American lawsuit against Boeing in the crash of the Ethiopian Airlines jet. That came yesterday. Boeing being sued by the family of a UN worker, one of the 157 people on board who were killed in that crash. More than 30 other lawsuits have been filed against Boeing for the Lion Air crash in October. What is at stake for Boeing with all these lawsuits?
Jeremy, it's hugely costly. They're going to ultimately probably settle a lot of these for a lot of money. All of that, though, just in financial terms, was priced in when Boeing's shares tumbled in the days following the crash, lost, I think, $35 billion in market capitalization. You know, the fact that these planes were likely to be grounded for a while priced in, too. So, for Boeing, as long as that's what happened, sort of what everybody expected, it can move forward. I think what the world is looking for here is an indication that, yes, that these planes are going to get back in the air safely, and that Boeing will be able to move on and deliver the rest of these 5,000 MAXs that it took orders for.
Mm-hmm. There's also been a lot of concern about how the FAA approved this new airplane, the 737 MAX, and the delayed decision to ground those planes. On Wednesday, the FAA's acting administrator, Daniel Elwell, appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee's Aviation Subcommittee, and he said the FAA is committed to safety.
The 737 MAX will return to service for U.S. carriers only when the FAA's analysis of the facts and technical data indicate that it is appropriate to do so.
So now they're being more careful. But Seth, why did it take so long for the FAA to ground the 737 MAX, especially given the news we're talking about today, that it looks more likely that the cause of both crashes is the same?
Jeremy, in a sense, the FAA was doing what it had always done, which was wait for the data from the flight data recorder. That's what it would have done in the past, and the world would have kind of accepted it. What's different now in this world is that literally minutes after the crash, anybody with a computer could jump on and, you know, kind of see what had happened. And then in the days following that crash, you had this satellite data. It's called ADS-B. That's what finally caused Canadian regulators, followed shortly by the FAA, to make the decision they did to ground the plane. So a lot of other information available, maybe changing the world in ways that the FAA hadn't thought about.
Seth, I know you're following this other airline story. Discount carrier WOW Airlines, based in Iceland, stopping operations this week, just closing up shop. Thousands of passengers stranded around the globe. What happened to WOW?
WOW was trying to do something that's really tough to do, and that's take that budget airline, that low-cost carrier business model, and try to cross oceans with it. I mean, everybody from Southwest Airlines to all the other airlines that have come after it, generally, they've been very successful in short-haul markets. But once you start trying to cross the Atlantic, well, then it's everybody from Sir Freddie Laker back in the 70s to People Express and on to the present day has struggled to do it. Larger Norwegian, by the way, another budget airline serving 14 or 15 U.S. cities, struggling to, not as badly as WOW Air, but it's a tough business model.
And by the way, passengers are not happy about it. Seth Kaplan here in Now's transportation analyst. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear more about how those passengers feel right now as we start our social media roundup with Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello. I hear that laugh as a laugh for somebody who's been delayed in the airport.
I feel bad for those people.
I know. Well, I kid the people who are stuck in Iceland right now. But what are you seeing online about this?
So much emotion. Here's Ali. I am trying to control my anger. Can anybody help me out with this unsavory situation before I slip into a rage coma? Hashtag WOW Airlines. A little bit of nostalgia here from Lily. She says that the WOW put Iceland on the map. They seem to create a price war for European travel. The purple leather seats were cool too. And then one more, just helping people out here, where there's a group of non-profit from a non-profit school who were hoping to go to Iceland. Their whole trip has been ruined. And then other troops are just piling in saying, hey, check out some of the cheaper airlines that are helping out. So Aer Lingus, for instance, has special fares. And if you go to WOW Airlines, their website is still up. It is still working. It will give you some advice if you've already booked and you're trying to get your money back.
You know, one of the things we're going to be looking into with this story is that the tourism in Iceland is based on some of these low-cost carriers that fly in and out of there and bring a lot of tourists in. Femi, we've also been seeing outrage this week online about the threat by the Trump administration to defund the Special Olympics. That came from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. But then yesterday, President Trump made a U-turn to assure that the Special Olympics will be funded after all this public outcry. What's the reaction online to the president's reversal?
Ecstatic. Obviously, some political pushback about the president changing his mind and maybe he was responsible for the budget cut in the first place. But let's just focus on the Special Olympics. Maria Shriver, the official blue tick, Maria Shriver from the Kennedy family, says thank you to everyone who raised their voice in support of the Special Olympics. She was moved to tears. So many people out supporting the Special Olympics. Major athlete Dikembe Mutombo, who is an NBA global ambassador. And he used to play for the NBA. He says, you cannot stop the Special Olympics movement. It's already too big. We will continue to support and participate at the Special Olympic Games. So lots of love, lots of support. But also, it drew attention, this whole budget crisis drew attention to what does the Special Olympics actually do? Regular people, just jumping in here. The actual J Law says, Special Olympics has done so much for my sister and her close friends. The games have turned my sister into a talented athlete. And if you go to @SpecialOlympics, you can find out all about the work that they do with the youngsters they involve, the youngsters they turn into athletes, the sports and games that they play, and also how life-changing that it can be.
So it turns out it was not good politics to go after those kids.
Not good politics. And also look out for this hashtag, choose to include. It's a special essence of what the Special Olympics means.
Femi, what do you make of Facebook's announcement this week? It's going to ban content that glorifies white nationalism on its platforms. It's going to start next week, and I guess there was some sort of loophole here that was allowing that content to get through.
It's really strange because we've spoken about this, and I'm sure everybody who's following social media knows that white separatists have been banned, but white nationalists have not, their content has not. And that's because Facebook was having this debate about, if you're white nationalist, does that mean that you're a racist? A lot of the advocacy groups were saying, yes, it does. And so only now are they getting round to doing a blanket ban. They were worried that some other minority advocacy groups might get caught up in a blanket ban, but that now they're enforcing it. So if you post or look for any content that is about white nationalism, you will get taken to another website. And that website is an anti-hate website that is run by former extremists.
Interesting.
Yes.
And is anyone protesting about that?
People are saying, well, this is about freedom of speech, and maybe we should be able to say and tweet and post whatever we want to say. So we've got Beechu here, posts on Twitter. Facebook will now be arbitrarily labelling anything you say or do that displeases them or the lawmakers that are breathing down their neck, white supremacy. Mm. We are in the media are excited about this victory in our way on your freedom. So there's some cynicism there that they're being policed.
Femi, there was a tweet that just came out this afternoon from the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, that says,
yes,
St. Louis, we're really worried about you. Give me a call. It's about bagels. Now, this is this is about the viral photo from St. Louis of bagels sliced like bread. What's the deal here just in the few seconds we have?
Okay, so if you look out for Alec Krautmann, he will show you on a tweet some beautiful bagels sliced into many slices.
What?
It started a huge debate. Exactly. Should you even eat a bagel like this? Stop attacking food, your monster, Mike P. Williams says.
And we're going to actually ask listeners to tell us what they think at HearNow.org. Femi, thank you.
You're so welcome.
The Trump administration is turning up the volume on its denunciation of how China treats its ethnic minorities. This week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met in Washington with Uyghur Muslims who have been affected by China's policy toward the region of Xinjiang in northwest China. China has detained about 1 million or more Uyghur Muslims in camps. The Chinese government calls them re-education camps. But the families of the detained, as well as Uyghurs who have been in the camps, describe torture and pressure to denounce their Muslim faith. Here's Mike Pompeo speaking on Capitol Hill Wednesday.
What's taking place with respect to the Uyghurs is tragic. The numbers are in the certainly hundreds of thousands. I think we use the words historic human rights abuse, and we're working to convince the Chinese that this practice is abhorrent and ought to be stopped.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman joins us from Washington. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And I was surprised when I saw those statements by Mike Pompeo. All administrations are careful about criticizing China on human rights. How significant is it that Pompeo met with Uyghur Muslims at the State Department and said what he said?
Well, it was. But, you know, Pompeo often talks about his priority of promoting religious freedoms around the world. But this was really the first time that he's putting such a big spotlight on what's happening in China. As you mentioned, he met with several Uyghurs, including with a woman, we're told, who shared her own experiences in these internment camps, and a woman who has 26 other relatives who are being detained. Pompeo wrote some very toughly worded tweets about this. He said that more than 1 million Uyghurs, ethnic Kazakhs, and other minorities have been in internment camps since 2017. He called on China to end the repression. And he also had his ambassador at large for religious freedom, Sam Brownback, come into the State Department briefing room yesterday. Brownback told us, and this is his quote, "China is waging a war on faith, and it's a war that China won't win." So very tough rhetoric here.
Well, and in fact, let's listen to more of Sam Brownback speaking about this issue at a press conference yesterday.
You have these security cameras brought around with artificial intelligence systems behind them that can data analyze facial recognition within, I'm told, 3 seconds of this individual, and a social credit system that you can get downgraded for going to the mosque, to the church, and then have that affect the rest of your life and your family.
There have also been reports of torture, electrocution, round-the-clock interrogations. China has denied that it's engaged in mass detention. What are they saying?
Yeah, I mean, China initially denied that these internment camps existed. Now they describe them as kind of vocational training centers that are meant to steer people away from extremism. Brownback says he's confronted Chinese officials at the UN about this, but it doesn't sound like he's really getting anywhere in any discussions on it.
Going back to the sort of big picture of the U.S. getting tough on China, I was thinking back to Hillary Clinton. Back in 1995, when her husband was president, she went to Beijing and she said, you know, famously, women's rights are human rights. But it turns out that in that speech, she actually made that statement without directly naming China as a violator of human rights. So is what's happening now related to the trade war between the U.S. and China and the administration trying to just take a tougher stance?
Well, I mean, in some ways it is. I mean, this administration hasn't spoken out forcefully on human rights elsewhere, but this does fit into the administration's approach. It's been calling out China on all sorts of issues, on this, on the theft of intellectual property rights, on its involvement in Africa and Latin America. And as you heard there with Brownback talking about this facial recognition technology that the U.S. is worried that China might export to other authoritarian governments.
Lots to watch there. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman in Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the state of New York has added members of the Sackler family to its lawsuit against Purdue Pharma. That's the maker of OxyContin. That announcement came just days after Purdue and the Sacklers, who own Purdue Pharma, agreed to pay $270 million to the state of Oklahoma. Over the past two decades, more than 200,000 people have died from prescription opioids alone. The U.S. is struggling to contain addiction, and it's even tougher for many people fighting addiction in jails across the country. Some states are funding an alternative system of justice in drug courts. The idea is to offer repeat offenders a chance at treatment instead of prison. In New Hampshire, advocates say they're starting to reduce the number of people with addiction who are re-offending. New Hampshire Public Radio's Sarah Gibson reports.
All righty, Mom, is the food done yet?
Not yet.
31-year-old Natasha Davis juggles a lot these days. She lives with her mom, raises three kids, and trains to be a drug recovery coach. Tonight, she's running out the door to an AA meeting.
Where's my keys? All right, Mom. I love you. You heard? I love you. I love you.
A year ago, life was different here. Davis was addicted to opioids, and to pay for them, she was committing crimes.
A little bit of everything. Drug dealing, selling women, robbing people.
Davis racked up dozens of charges over the years and spent months at the county jail. She overdosed a few times, tried rehab 8 times, but she kept going back.
I really wanted to stop using. Like, there were times where I was in the bathroom with a needle in my neck and a crack pipe right next to me, just crying in the mirror, begging God to help me. Like, why can't I stop? But I couldn't do it. I could not do it on my own.
Then came an arrest last year during a drug sting. Davis is now facing state prison time. She got one last chance, drug court.
So the idea with drug court is to break the cycle.
That's Judge Jacqueline Colburn. She helped start the drug court in Nashua, New Hampshire, around 5 years ago. She was sick of seeing people like Davis cycle through jail and prison where they didn't get the help they needed.
The reality is when they're released back to the same community, the same situation. Their skill set is no greater than it was when they went in, and they will continue to do that which they know how to do.
In drug court, participants get treatment and community supervision. The program lasts about 2 years, and it's divided into phases.
So if you're in a phase one participant, your life is pretty much 24/7 drug court.
Participants spend hours each day in mandatory group and individual therapy. They have random curfew checks and urine tests multiple times a week. And they have to check in with the drug court team and the rest of participants on Tuesdays. After that, it can be years more of probation.
I'm state property, basically.
But if she completes the program, Davis doesn't have to go to prison. At the beginning, Davis learned the two rules of drug court: show up and be honest no matter what.
Drug court doesn't like to be lied to, especially Judge Colburn. Do not lie to Judge Colburn or Nellie especially.
Nelly is the probation officer. Another person on the drug court team you shouldn't lie to, Lieutenant Brian Kenny. He's in charge of narcotics at the Nashua Police. Kenny and his officers keep tabs on all the drug court participants. He says many struggle at first with telling the truth to cops.
To be honest, I don't even expect it in the beginning. I expect it not to occur if we're getting the right people into drug court. It's supposed to be the most high-risk offenders that we have. You know, and that's high risk of reoffending and high risk, frankly, of overdosing.
In the first phase of drug court, it's expected you'll have a relapse. That happened to Davis, but she got help and stayed in drug court. Her urine tests were clean for 5 months. Then she tested positive for a prohibited substance. That's why she's back in court. Davis heads into the courtroom with about 10 other women. There's a table set up in the middle where a team of social workers, cops, a public defender, and recovery coaches sit with Judge Colburn. Participants join the table one by one to talk about how they're doing. This accountability to community, it's a big part of why people say drug court works. With one woman, the team believes she's relapsed, but she's denying it, which gets eye rolls from other participants. Another woman, Davis's former drug dealer, is about to graduate. Then it's Davis's turn.
All right, Natasha, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Better?
Better. What's that mean?
Davis says she's been depressed, but she's getting help at the recovery center. Then they get down to business. Davis explains to Judge Colburn that the urine test was positive because some cold medicine she was taking contained a banned ingredient. Colburn gives Davis a warning, no punishment.
So bump in the road this week around the cold medicine.
Yeah.
Right. So when I read the report, I was sort of surprised because I thought, wow, Natasha's so smart and she knows what's on the do not take list.
Davis tells me later, this kind of thing makes her feel like a teenager, but she gets it. And there's positive affirmation here, too, for volunteering at a recovery center and for not relapsing during a depression.
So despite having to come in on your unscheduled week, it's not all bad, right? So advice to your peers.
Don't take cold medicine.
The people in this room believe in drug court. Many have dedicated their life to it. Others say they owe their life to it. But not everyone's on board. Lieutenant Kenny says he was a skeptic at first. And many officers think people who do drugs are just going to commit crimes and should be behind bars.
These are folks that you did a lot of hard work on to place under arrest and to get into the court system to solve whatever problem was occurring in the city. And now they're just back in the community? How is this possible?
But the numbers swayed Kenny. Drug courts typically cost less than half of what it costs to incarcerate people. And national data says they reduce the amount of people who reoffend by at least a third. There are now 10 drug courts in New Hampshire. The question is how well they work in the long run. The Nashua Drug Court, along with others in the state, will be tracking people once they've graduated from drug court to see what happens 3 years down the road. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Gibson.
The pink mustache has been spotted on Wall Street. The ride-hailing company Lyft went public today, valued at an eye-popping $24 billion, and shares jumped up as soon as they went on the market. Co-founder Logan Green told CNBC today that the company has room to run.
You know, if you look at the entire ride-sharing industry, it still makes up less than 1% of all vehicle miles traveled. So again, we're just scratching the surface of what we can do.
Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
So Lyft, $24 billion. It has not made a profit. What do investors see in it?
Well, you said the magic word in the introduction, and it's growth. Investors love a good growth story. Now, Lyft hasn't posted a profit. Last year, it lost more than $900 million.
Wow.
But its sales are really growing quite robustly. They doubled last year to about $2.2 billion. So the bet, the hope is that those sales will grow at a faster clip than expenses and the profits will be there one day in the future.
Lyft is just one of the big tech IPOs that are expected this year. Uber is coming up next. Airbnb is on the docket. There's the office messaging platform Slack, which we use here, by the way. Are all these IPOs normal?
This is expected to be an exceptionally strong year for IPOs. The estimates are anywhere from about $80 billion to $100 billion of issuance this year. And that would rank it as one of the biggest IPO years in history as far as the total value of the stock that's been sold.
Now, you have written in Bloomberg that the bankers seem to be whispering in the ears of these unicorns, and a unicorn is a company that's valued at $1 billion, telling them that the grass is high in public markets and now is the time to graze because a drought is coming. That is ominous and it's evocative. What do you mean by it?
Yeah, that's just my flowery way of describing what is a common suspicion on Wall Street whenever there's a huge IPO or a very heavy year of various IPOs like this, is that people start to worry that the private investors in these companies and their advisors think that this bull market in stocks, which is 10 years old now, one of the oldest we've seen, that it can't go on forever, that they really have to come to the market now to sell those shares while the sentiment is strong and prices are high.
So are you saying that these companies and that Wall Street can see something that the rest of us can't?
Again, it's just describing that suspicion, that concern that traders have. But I will say that the last time we saw IPO issuance this strong in the neighborhood of $100 billion, which is what it's expected to be this year, that was in 1999 and 2007, and those were right before really nasty bear markets. So that, coupled with some of the other concerning things going on in the economy, is sort of all coming together to make people a little bit worried about all this issuance.
So if that's true and a slowdown is coming, wouldn't these companies know that they would suffer if they went public just before a big downturn in the stock market?
Well, the companies would, but you know, think of from the perspective of the investors that put a lot of money into them as private companies.
They'd get paid out.
They want to get paid out,
yeah,
right?
I see. All right, Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. It is a pleasure to speak with you as always.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Ann Litt is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California, and joins us once again. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Jeremy.
And today we're going to be talking about South by Southwest because you just got back from there and you're going to bring us some of the music that you heard there. First of all, how was it?
It was incredible. I think it was one of the best years in a few years.
Okay, well, the first artist you've brought us is Yola. This is called Faraway Look.
Handing out the paper plates to all your friends that you adore. Are you home?
I almost feel like I'm listening to something out of the 60s right now, Anne.
That's exactly how I felt when I first heard it. Dusty Springfield. Mm-hmm. There's so many great country soul artists. She comes from Bristol, England, though, which is what I find so fascinating about her. And she made her album in Nashville.
And a beautiful voice there.
Oh, it's sort of Adele, but a little rougher. I had a great chance to interview her backstage, and we talked about the title of her album, Walk Through Fire.
And what did she say?
Well, she literally had to walk through fire. She was in a fire, a house fire. And in this moment, she told me, when she basically lit herself on fire accidentally, and she was having this moment of, how do I put this out and where do I go from here? She always said afterwards that if I can walk through fire, I can do anything. And
wow.
I would rather walk through fire than live the life I lived before. And that sort of opened her up. She's 35 years old to this whole new world of music. And She was part of the Bristol scene, worked with Massive Attack and Bugs in the Attic, but her voice is so much bigger than those sort of more minimalist electronic artists.
Amazing. And actually, the next song that you brought us is called Fire. This is by the Black Pumas. Sounds like it was a soulful experience there at South by Southwest, Anne.
I was just thinking the exact same thing while we were listening to that. A psychedelic soul project. It's Black Pumas. They're actually from Austin, so it was a home game for them in town.
And the lead vocals you hear there are from 27-year-old Eric Burton, who made his way to Austin from L.A. back in 2015. How did this project come to be?
Well, he teamed up with a producer called Adrian Quesada, who you might know from his work with Brownout. And they just got heavily into this sort of psychedelic soul thing. Wu-Tang meets James Brown, just a dancing funk and soul. This is my breakout band for 2019. And they just got together and made magic.
Okay, the next artist on your list didn't actually perform this year at South by Southwest, although she has in the past. And you heard her new song, which we're about to hear. This is Jamila Woods with Eartha.
I used to be afraid of myself, hung my smile on a shelf, hid my teeth when I laugh. Now I'm far too grown for your plot, for your bomb. Will you rule for me or will you leave? I don't wanna compromise. Can we make it through the
Now, this song is called Eartha because it is an homage to Eartha Kitt.
Exactly. And Jamila says it was inspired by the badass spirit and wisdom of Eartha Kitt. And I was really lucky to hear her because I was part of a panel at South by Southwest where we just listened blindly to a bunch of music, not knowing who it was. I recognized Jamila's voice, but this song just killed me. And the whole room, it was a great panel. Everybody had to hold up a number, you know, 1 through 10 to rate it. And this was like tens across the board.
Wow. And she's got a new album coming out this May called Legacy.
Yes.
Legacy.
And what she does on this album is pay tribute to Black and Brown icons like the writer James Baldwin, Miles Davis, Frida Kahlo, Sun Ra. Each song is a tribute to another one of these artists who has inspired her throughout the years. And I can't wait for it. Her take on neo-soul is just breathtaking.
Okay, on to Cuba, but something that was at South by Southwest. This is Sima Funk with Me Voy, which means I'm going.
Ya se acabó la fiesta, en la calle no hay nada, pero tú estás pa' cosas y yo no estoy pa' drama. Vamos a ponernos de acuerdo, los dos queremos lo mismo. Yo puedo seguir pa' mi casa o puedo cogerte el ritmo. Dime que tú quieras hacer pa' yo saber que voy a hacer pa' bla, 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 no tengo tiempo. Ya me está cayendo la impaciencia, no da sombrecita, suelto el coro del momento. Me voy pa' mi casa.
Buenas noches, diferentes.
Now, if you translate the lyrics there, he's saying, I'm going home to my house, but if you want, I could go to yours. Tell us more about Sima Funk.
Well, they're out of Havana, and they're really doing an amazing job of blending the past and the present. It's pop, it's funk, it's James Brown, it's 70s, it's Afro-Cuban music, but it blends so many different genres. And Jeremy, you and I have talked about this in the past, my love of genre blending, but their live show is like none other I've ever seen. I saw them completely by accident and was transfixed. I ran out and bought the album right after I saw them. And frankly, the album doesn't do the live show justice.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, Anne, and this sort of keeps the tropical vibe going. This is Claude Fontaine with Pretending He Was You.
All through the fall.
This sounds very familiar, Anne.
Well, she has a love affair with bossa nova. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about Claude Fontaine, she's actually American, and she was living in London and just up the street from a very famous record store called Honest John's, which really specializes in what you would call world music, a lot of reggae. She fell in love with the sounds of both Tropicália and bossa nova, as well as sort of rock steady, reggae music, dub music. And her new album, which is coming out, is one side bossa nova inspired and one side reggae inspired. Two sides and two sides of her. She recorded it in Los Angeles at Chet Baker's studio, and she made a wish list of musicians she wanted to work with, and she kind of got them all.
Well, it sounds like South by Southwest was a lot of fun for you.
It was, and listening back to this music, there was also a lot of great sort of Americana and folk and rock, and these were just some that caught my ear across some different genres.
Okay, well, we will put all these at our website, hereandnow.org. People can also find them on Spotify. Our playlist is NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music. Anne Litt, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you for having me.
This Sunday, voters in Ukraine head to the polls to elect a president. It's a crowded race, but the frontrunner, Volodymyr Zelensky, is well known across the country, and not for politics. Zelensky is the star of this hit TV show in Ukraine. Back there he was, playing the role of the Ukrainian president. Margaret Coker is managing editor for the online news organization CODA Story. She's been following this election. Margaret, welcome.
Hi, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So I'll tell you what, this sounds like a story of life imitating art in Ukraine. Tell us about this actor turned politician who may well be the next president.
Yes, it's definitely a new twist on fact and fiction. So there is one of the most popular TV shows in Ukraine is a program called Servant of the People. And it's basically, you know, Ukrainian goes to Washington in that old Jimmy Stewart movie that we know so well in the States. So a school teacher decides that he wants to clean up corruption and he suddenly becomes president. And the man who plays this character on TV is called Volodymyr Zelensky. And he is now running for president in real life. So when you're talking to Ukrainians now ahead of the polls this weekend, you know, they are super excited that this man who entertains them on TV once a week and has this very famous acting troupe that goes across the country on tours, he might turn into their next national leader, even though he has no political experience whatsoever.
And I understand he has the backing of a powerful TV network that also has a grudge against the current president, Petro Poroshenko.
That's right. In Ukraine, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, you know, there have been mega millionaires that they call oligarchs. And one of these oligarchs runs the TV network on which Zelensky's TV program runs. And so Zelensky has a lot of free airtime, shall we say. It doesn't hurt his chances in the presidential polls that he has a new season of his popular TV show that has just started in March. So every week, Ukrainians can see him play his popular character on TV, and they can also see him in advertisements as well as campaign rallies. So yeah, the oligarch that runs the TV network is making sure that his preferred candidate is being plastered everywhere.
And what about Petro Poroshenko? How did he fall so far behind? Because wasn't he something of a hero just a few years ago when he stood up against Russia's annexation of Crimea?
That's right. Back in 2014, there was a lot of tumult in Ukraine. There was the popular revolution that happened in the streets of the capital, Kiev. They overthrew one president, seen too close to Russia, and Pyotr Poroshenko came in and helped keep the nation together at a time when Russian-backed insurgents were waging war in the eastern province of Donbass, and Russia itself has tried to annex Crimea, another very major province of Ukraine. So amid
all of this almost civil war, Poroshenko's done a great job in keeping the nation together and trying to keep the economy afloat at a time of a huge depression. And analysts say now that he's almost a victim of his own success. He's done so well that voters feel like they can take a chance on an outsider, and that outsider is Zelensky.
And he's not out of it yet, because there could be a runoff later in the year, depending on how this weekend's vote goes.
That's right. All the polls at this point show Zelensky is definitely in the lead, but he doesn't have a simple majority, which is necessary to win outright. So everyone is expecting that this presidential election is going to go to a runoff, and there'll be three top candidates. One of them will be Zelensky, the comedian turned politician, Poroshenko, the incumbent, and a third person, a woman who's a former prime minister.
Now, we mentioned Crimea. Of course, this is a very sore spot for many Ukrainians after 2014 and the annexation. What role is that playing in this election, and are the Russians paying attention?
Well, I think definitely the Russians are paying close attention to this right now. The fact of the matter is, though, that people who live in Crimea won't be voting in the Ukrainian elections. They are de facto now part of Russia. So they're basically a blank slate. Nobody is polling them, and they're not going to participate. What Russia probably cares more about is if they can do business and keep doing backroom deals with the next presidential winner, whoever he or she may be.
Finally, I want to ask you about the shadow that Paul Manafort has cast over Ukrainian politics over the past couple of years. Of course, this is the former Trump campaign manager who was very active in the past in his support for the former pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych. That was very controversial work. I just wonder if Paul Manafort's name is percolating at all, or if it still resonates with people in Ukraine as they get ready to vote again for president.
Well, Manafort himself isn't a talking point, but the symbolism of what Manafort has done is definitely part of this campaign. I mean, one of the Achilles heels of the incumbent, Poroshenko, is that he's seen as not making any headway in cleaning up corruption. And Manafort, of course, became such a scandalous figure in Ukraine, if not in America, because he was seen as taking bribes and being part of this kind of shadow black economy that has been thriving in Ukraine. To the detriment of the national economy at large. So Poroshenko's lack of ability to try and clean up the swamp and put people on trial for corruption is one of the reasons why he may actually lose this race.
That's Margaret Coker. She's managing editor for the online news organization CODA Story. Margaret, thanks for talking to us about this.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.